The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee members. We had stopped on page 9, slide 17. Representative Poppy, who isn't here, was on the list, and Representative Johnson was on the list, and neither of them are here. So, Mr. Fitzenreiter, why don't you continue, and we'll let them ask their questions when they arrive.
Mr. Chairman, while we boot things up here, we're going to get greetings to the committee. Glad we can pick up this conversation again on what is slide page 10 of the handout, slide 19. And we've been talking a lot about the internal budget process and how the biennial budget, annual budgets put together, some about tuition. We're going to move into the rest of the discussion today and again, however long it takes for us to plow through this presentation. But today, we're going to start with our what we call the internal budget model. So we've moved away from process, and we want to just share with you the internal process of what we use, or we call our internal budget model. And it's the internal budget model is the way the university, it's a set of guidelines for how we attribute revenue in the institution and attribute costs. And it all plays into ultimately the budget decisions by the university that are ultimately approved by the president and the Board of Regents. So with that, I'm going to give a little bit of history.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, before you begin that slide, Representative Poppy has arrived, and she did have a question. It was either on slide 17 or a previous slide. So if you, Representative Poppy, to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies to the Chair and to the committee for being late. Yes, my question was about the budget proposals and as they come forward, with particular interest in the outreach research stations and institutes and likewise, and how they actually develop the budget and how they're included. So kind of who, what, when, how that works for places like the Hormel Institute, which is a research station within my district. Thank you.
Mr. Fitzenreiter or Ms. Tonenson, yes. Which one?
Good afternoon. I will take that, Mr. Chair and members. There was a slide.
Ms. Tonenson, why don't you identify yourself for the record again today, just to make sure we got it.
Certainly. Julie Tonenson. I am the Associate Vice President for Budget and Finance and the Budget Director for the university. And we did a slide that listed all of the primary budget units. I'm not finding which number that was.
Slide 16.
Yes, slide 16. These are the primary budget units of the university. And every center, every outreach center, every organization within the university rolls up to one of these primary budget units. So in your example, the Hormel Institute, for example, rolls up to the Vice President for Research in his office. And that office brings forward any proposals they have for all of the units within it. So as I mentioned the other day, each one of these primary units may have a little bit different internal process for how they gather information from their subordinate units. So it depends on the unit, but some process they have, they will be able to forward any issues, any financial issues they have or proposals they have, or any reallocation ideas and so forth, go up through their internal process to the leader of this level of unit. And then that level, so in this case, the Vice President for Research, brings forward his priorities from all of his units to our process, in which we listen to them every year about what their issues are, and we go from there.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just as a follow-up, how many... So I believe you said there were five or six of you that kind of at the end are the people that maybe hear all of these and make those decisions. How many would a typical supervisor manager person have as far as units that they are responsible for bringing forward those budget recommendations?
Ms. Donaldson.
If I'm Mr. Chair and members, if I'm understanding the question correctly, each one of these 50 or so brings forward their proposals, And each one of these has different numbers underneath them. So the College of Liberal Arts might have 35 departments. The Humphrey Institute might have two. The coordinate campuses have a lot of different units that report up from, including facilities and so forth. So it varies by unit in terms of how many sub-departments they have within them. But they all come up equally to that group of five or six. And we, that group of five, actually try to represent the university as a whole, not segments of it, in our conversations.
Representative Poppy. Yeah, Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Tonneson, would we be able to access some sort of organizational chart that shows exactly what how that lays out, what comes under each of these primary budget units?
Ms. Tonneson or Mr. Fitzgerald?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there is a university organizational chart. When we get later in the discussion, we can also show you the complexity of how that financial structure works vis-a-vis the organizational chart. One of the challenges that the university has, and I alluded to it in a publication that I forget the name of, that comes out of something with Wall Street in it, it has been a problematic for the university to determine through its HR system sort of the spans and layers in the organization, which I think is really an org chart. It's not that we don't have an org chart, but the reliability of that HR system is going to need a lot of work. But we'll go back and get for you what we do have. I'm just not going to suggest that it is entirely accurate.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, I think the Wall Street Journal article may be one of the few things most of the legislators have read. So your allusion is very appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, are there more questions or should we
proceed? No, I have no, unless Representative Johnson is here, I don't see him. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Brighter, do you want to continue? Do you have another one?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I just thought, given Representative Poppy's question, it's very unclear here how we would, if I were looking for the Hormel Institute or any other unit, I would not be able to tell from this list how to proceed. So some sort of logical key that we could research on our own if we wanted to make that connection or understand.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee will turn to the internal budget model and give you just a little history of which I think is important to understand where we are today in this process. Back in 1992, it is when I started at the University of Minnesota, and there was a popular concept floating around the country. It started in Indiana, migrated to Harvard. It was called RCM, or Responsibility Center Management. It got a very bad name in the early part of the 90s, because in higher ed, it got this connotation that every tub on its own bottom in higher ed. You either, Department X, Y, or Z either survived on its own or didn't. And it got a bad name. But the important thing about RCM that the university then subsequently adopted was it is a part of our budget model, our version of it. And it was designed to grow our way out of budget problems. Back in the 90s, I mean, higher ed and public services has always been stretched and challenged. And there was a feeling that we wanted to, back in the 90s, incent those 50-odd major organizational units to think creatively and grow revenues. We also wanted to, at the time, increase the transparency about how decisions were made. We wanted to clarify, there was a lot of things going on in higher ed. Was tuition from a undergraduate student subsidizing the medical school? Well, RCM, our version of RCM, allowed us to clarify all that, and we have that system in place. But like anything, in order to get it adopted, we changed the name and called it Incentives for Managed Growth. And one of the big and most important things we did in that system in the 90s is, at the time, the vast majority of the revenue at the institution back in the early 90s was controlled centrally. So, for example, if a dean of the law school or the dean of CLA or the business school or the medical school wanted to increase their enrollment, they would have to come to central, to the chief academic officer, and asked them, can I increase my enrollment 100 students and can I keep the money? And the senior academic officer at the time, Jim Infante, who was a mathematician, would say, well, I'll tell you what, you can have 50 cents on the dollar and I'll take the other 50 cents to pay other bills. Another dean would come in, or in fact, dean would come in and say, can I increase my enrollment 300 students, can I keep the money? Jim would say, I'll give you 35 cents on the dollar. And the deans would have lunch, and there was an outcry, I'm oversimplifying it some, but there was an outcry that there weren't any incentives in this system to reward the colleges. And there was no incentive to control costs either in the colleges. What we did in 1998, it was President Udoff pulled the trigger on it at the time, is we took the tuition revenue that was coming central, controlled central. Remember, the Board of Regents and the President still control the decision about the rate, but the revenue from tuition is now attributed to the college directly in our internal budget model. And it's, as well as that, we took half what is ICR money. Indirect cost recovery money is the reimbursement the university gets over the direct costs of a grant. We'll talk about that more later. But the important feature here is back in the 90s, the university had, we would, Donna Peterson at the time, myself, would come to the legislature. And one of the big complaints we had from legislators was this, well, I'm hearing from my constituents that they can't get their class. There's course access problems. Well, this system really did away with, for the most part, with course access problems because there was now an incentive in the colleges that if they opened up another section of Spanish, they actually got the money. The college got the money. Before, there wasn't that incentive. And my point of bringing this up is that at the University of Minnesota, and I think in higher ed in general, it's very responsive to incentives. And this system has worked very well. It created some problems along the way that we have modified since then. And I want to turn to my colleague Julie Tennyson to bring it up to today and tell you how this actually works at the University of Minnesota.
Ms. Tennyson,
I see a question.
Representative Swininski.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitz, maybe you're going to get into that, and maybe my question is just a little bit, it seems to go that way, but looking at, obviously we have some majors that are revenue positive and some potentially are not. But do you kind of adjust that, I'm guessing, between disciplines so that, maybe an engineering or a more intense type degree would keep a larger percentage of tuition and less than some other areas, that type of scenario? Do you adjust that, or do you kind of have a, how does that relationship
Mr.
work?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this model is one that is driven to the college level. How deans operate that model further into the departments within their college does run differently across the institution. But it is, we drive this model to the dean level. How it works after that varies across the institution. It has made the deans and the faculty of the colleges much more aware of the needs of students because there's a connection with the money and the financial health of the college.
Representative Swininski, is that Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you've developed this model, as you said, it's going toward the department or the college. Faculty are aware of it. How have you dealt with the fact that it may be an incentive for a department or a college, but not necessarily for the entire university? And my question is, so if you have students in a certain college, and those faculty maybe now begin offering other classes that would not have typically been offered in that college. They might have been offered in a different college, College of Liberal Arts, for instance, but now they're in College of Business or something. And so the incentive is to grow their own college larger without collaborating across the university. And that, to me, would be detrimental for the whole, but while being beneficial for the particular unit. So can you just describe how that works and whether or not that is, in fact, the best solution?
Mr. Fitzenreiter or Ms. Tonnenson, who's
Ms. Tonnenson. Mr. Chair members, I'll start and they can fill in if they have more to add. There's a couple things, actually. We did look into this, that particular concern early on after we implemented this revenue side of the model, and there really was little actual evidence of that happening. I wouldn't say none, but there was little evidence of it actually happening. The second thing is we also, when we implemented this, made it pretty clear that that monitoring of the academic program delivery was an academic responsibility, and the model, any model that you pick is going to have good and bad incentives in it. It's going to have, you have to decide which pieces you're going to manage, and the decision was at this time that there, the benefits outweighed that potential disadvantage, and that the academic programming and the provost and so forth would monitor that activity, and through approval of program and approval of courses in that side of the institution would eliminate that problem. We can't say we have anecdotal evidence that it occurs here and there, but it isn't a widespread issue at this point.
Mr. Chairman, members, I just also add two things. I mean, we certainly found that this model increases the need for academic leadership and academic strategic planning. It makes things much more transparent. And so I think we certainly found that. I'd also say that under Vice Provost McMaster, who's here today, the university has a university-wide curriculum committee now to address some of the exactly some of those issues, so that we don't start, the business school does not have independent authority, for example, to start teaching Spanish.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just based on the fact that you had some difficulty with your HR reporting and making sure that there's streamlined and that everybody knows those numbers, I guess I'm just wondering a bit about the oversight. I understand you're saying that there is some of that and there's some review and whatever, but as this, you know, where there's a kernel, there might be a bushel, and you might need to be a little bit more cognizant of that possibility of that growing into, you know, it's good to address it initially, but the ongoing oversight, I'm just curious about.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have very robust, strong controls, in my opinion, over the curriculum and course offerings. Our weakest link is HR. We don't have a weak link, in my opinion, in the student side.
So, Mr. Fitzenreiter, on slide 7, the enrollee growth from 2003 to 2012, which was small compared to all the numbers we've been seeing, has been a controlled growth and not a growth for any other reason, but it's been a controlled growth down to the department level, campus level. Mr. Paulson.
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, I would say that's absolutely true. In fact, there's, Vice Provost McMaster can certainly speak to this, but there is enrollment increases in any program go through quite a bit of review, both at the college level and at the university level. There's all sorts of things that cap capacity. For example, in biological sciences, where we've recently added students, there's so many lab benches over so many time slots for so many majors. We have to be able to serve all those students very well. And so those are the types of things that, types of discussions we have all the time.
Okay. Representative Johnson, did I just see him come in? Representative Johnson, you were on the list when we began, and do you still wish to ask a question here?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had my question answered offline.
Representative Winkler is up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for coming in late. I'd like to pick up on the thread that we were on just as we adjourned at the last meeting, which was the role of the Board of Regents in the budget approval process, and it's your slide 17. And we discussed the Regents' interactive role, I guess, with the administration, so that by the time they actually get a proposed budget in front of them, they're well versed in it, they understand it, and you they may have had an opportunity for input along the way. And one of the things that you mentioned was a financial plan that the university has. I think you said it's prospective, looking out 10 years, something like that.
He's holding six fingers up. But Mr. Fitzgerald, you want to articulate those fingers?
Of the committee, we do a rolling 6 year. We could do 10, but we think six is probably about as good as you're going to really. Past that, I think the reliability is kind of questionable. So we do six.
Representative Winkle. Well,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenrider, we can't do two, past two. So that's not too bad. But I'm curious what assumptions you make about the growth rate of tuition and the trajectory of state appropriations over that 6 years.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we also do that in sort of an interactive way. What we've generally started is we start with a baseline, and that baseline has, in this last go around, we used the 10-year historical average of state appropriation, which for us was negative 0.7%. We understand that actually waves, but we can't necessarily anticipate how that's going to wave. And we started our conversation with a tuition increase rate of zero, because what the board wanted to see was a baseline that, and then we also inflated costs, so we showed a gap that came out over time. And then the work with the board interactively is, what are the policy levers in play to close that gap, to bring forth a balanced budget over a six-year time frame?
Mr. Colson, so do you then identify, I mean, obviously it's not hard to do the math and do the subtraction on the growth rate assumptions, but do you project cost savings over that six-year period? Do you identify potential ways of reducing various cost items that you have? How detailed do you get in producing a balanced budget over that 6 years, assuming 0% tuition, mm-hmm. increased costs, and flat mm-hmm. In nominal dollars, but I suppose declining real dollar mm-hmm. state appropriations?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes. Obviously, the farther out you go, so we're playing both the revenue side and the expense side in the projections. Obviously, the farther out you go, the less detail you might have in an exact cost reduction. But, for example, we have a program to reduce total square footage and energy costs at the University of Minnesota. And we can work with our facility folks to say, well, how fast do you think savings will come? Or are we just constraining growth over current baseline? And is that a 2 year out, 4 year out, 6 year out assumption? And that's the sort of work that we do. We do the same thing on, quite frankly, on fringe benefit and healthcare costs. So as we are thinking proactively about changes in our healthcare mix, how does that impact that broad expense line? So we're playing both sides.
Mr. Chairman, just to add a footnote to that, we do work hard vis-a-vis the Board of Regents itself to align this long-range planning, which is higher up, 30,000 feet. We try to align that and keep that in mind as we're developing the biennial budget proposal, and then align that further with the financial framework that guides the annual budget process, and then ultimately the annual budget, the detailed annual budget brought to the board. And then the cycle starts again.
So and I'm sure if this is for which testifier, but this financial plan sets a framework, a high-level framework. And so if you come in with a budget that suggests additional investment in certain program priorities of the president, and tuition increases, does that sort of operate as a change item type approach? So you assume zero tuition, you assume cost reductions, you assume whatever you assume for your state appropriation, and then you kind of develop a change item list, such as if we want to do these new programs, then we have to raise tuition by this amount to get there?
Mr. Chairman, Fitzgerald. Members, I would say that's a fair characterization of the process. We'll be looking at, can we grow new revenues? Do we need to pull back on that investment assumption? What's the impact on tuition? What can we do about the health, our fringe benefit costs? Are we going to have a pay increase or not have a pay increase? We're pulling all those levers available through that high-level model, and then we're just continually trying to refine it as we go through the budget planning cycle of a whole year.
Representative Winkler.
And then finally, Mr. Chair, is it possible, as you're looking at these operational reductions, to break them into simple categories like faculty who are teaching, faculty who are engaged in research, non-faculty employees who are providing direct services to students, non-faculty employees who are not engaged in direct service to students, and overall costs that directly support teaching and scholarship as opposed to the various other activities? Is it possible to just kind of drill in on categories in that way? And if so, is that the kind of thing that we could have a view of of what you've done historically?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Chairman, members, we have not done historically the kind of categories that you just mentioned. Would it be possible going forward, if that's the focus, how we wanted people to respond to a reallocation or a budget cut? Yes, but going backwards, we haven't done it specifically that way.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, Representative Winkler is getting at what the intent of these hearings are all about, both forwards and backwards, but certainly going forward, knowing what those categories are and who's in them is what these hearings are intended to get us to do, to articulate what your budget is before we look at your budget request. So you will be going into next week. If that would be helpful to Representative Winkler, it would be helpful to the committee. And I'm not saying you can provide it Monday, but at some future time, it would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, I like I said, we haven't last year or the year before, categorized or collected things along the categories that you mentioned. That's all I wanted to make sure you understood.
Mr. Fitzgerald.
And to recreate that would be very difficult at this point.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, when we get to the end of this and we have an omnibus bill, I've already put into the outline one of the things I'd like to have this committee, and Minsky and the others know about it, a statutory way of doing just exactly what Representative Winkler has proposed in more detail probably, so that we know this is the money you got, this is how you spent it, and then you'd be prepared to tell us, in Representative Winkler's example, of the details, so that we know the validity of the budget proposal that you're going to offer at some point in this committee. So I'm saying that that's one of the goals at the end of all of these hearings when we get to the omnibus bill. So just so folks are prepared, and I'm going to say it publicly again and remind them, and as you know, I tend to remind people often. It helps when we get to the end. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I just add to that, if there, you know, when we get to that final bill, if as far as the budget proposal, if you have comparative data with other similar size universities, you know, historical and comparative, and I tend to repeat myself too. I learned that from my wife. The other thing, who decides on, what's the process for deciding on dropping course offerings or adding course offerings? Is that done by each department in terms of, you know, completing a major?
Mr. Carlson or Ms. Pennens?
Mr. Chairman, we're phoning a friend.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the
record. Sure. Robert McMaster. I'm the Vice Provost and Dean of Undergraduate Education. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's handled at the departmental level. So if a department wants to add a course, delete a course, change the name of a major, any kind of change like that, they would make. That would then be approved by a collegiate curriculum committee, and then that would bubble up to the central level where it would pass through the provost's office, and we would also see and approve that change.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grunin.
Thank you for that response. I guess I was watching the news this morning, 5 o'clock, and you're maybe aware of the course, too, that's being offered. It deals with female sexuality, and some of the description that they brought up seemed I guess some people might consider inappropriate, even on a news channel like that. When I looked it up here, it has a court. It's a symposium for $3,500. Is that being paid for with any tax dollars,
Mr. McMaster?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not aware of that particular course, and so I'm not sure I can comment on that or seminar. I think we may have someone here who can talk to that.
Mr. Fitzenrider? No. Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Hi. Mr. Chair and representatives, my name is Peg Lundquist. I'm the director of the Women's Center, and it's not a course. It's an event that we have planned, and it's on sexual health and making sexual decisions that are right for people, and analysis of messages women receive, body image, learning to say no. I think some of the hoopla in the media is about the first half of the title, which is female orgasms, and the second half is sexual health and female empowerment. But it really is about sexual health. It's just, as you know, marketing is important, and we want students to come to the program. And this program, which is a national program, has been held in a lot of college campuses and been approved by a lot of administrators, does have that title.
Excuse me, you were a little fast in the beginning. Could you repeat your name for us?
Sorry, my name is Peg Lundquist, and I'm the director of the Women's Center at the university.
Ms. Chair, just to...
Representative Gruenhagen.
So my question, though, is the cost is $3,500.
Correct.
For the symposium. Who's are taxpayers paying for that?
Correct.
Ms. Lundquist.
Yeah, some of it comes from from our budget, which comes through the Office for Equity and Diversity, which is taxpayer money, and some comes through student fees because we have co-sponsors for the program.
Okay.
Representative Gruney.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Ms. Lundquist, just a question. How long has the Women's Studies Department been at the university?
So we're at the Women's Center, which is Women's not Center. Women's Studies. Women's Studies is academic arm, and we do leadership and advocacy on campus. And we are the oldest Women's Center in the country. We've been here 52 years.
52 years. Thank you.
Other question? Thank you.
Mr. Fitzenrider?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we'll get back to the slideshow here and turn to my colleague.
All right.
Ms. Tomlinson.
The budget model. So as Fitz mentioned earlier, this is an RCM, a responsibility center management type of budget model. We call it the earned income and full cost model, and this is in place today. And how it works is all of the revenues that you see on the left side of the page, tuition, ICR, fees, gifts, sales income, etc., are attributed directly to the units that generate them, so the colleges and or the campuses that generate them. The state appropriation in the separate box down on the bottom is allocated also to the academic units, and it's an annual decision by the president and the board as to where that money goes. The revenue and the expense are both allocated at that primary budget unit that was on that previous slide, 16. So that's a college or a major support unit. Or a campus. Academic units, as on that slide again, I refer back to that slide 16, are the ones on the left. So those are the ones that are getting the tuition, the sales income, the state appropriation. All of the support units, which were on the right side of that previous slide, all of their budgets are in a cost pool, which is the right side of this slide. So we have created cost pools that we then charge to the academic units. So all of the revenue, including the state appropriation, is allocated to the academic units, and they in turn pay their direct costs from those revenues and their indirect or university support costs, which are in the cost pools you see over on the right. So our Office of Budget and Finance, which is a support unit, our budget is in a cost pool over on the right called Support Service Unit Cost Pool, the bottom one on that list, along with the budget for the general counsel and HR and university relations and so forth. They're all in that cost pool. And that's how it works. Everything gets paid for. All the revenue goes to the academic units, and they pay all of the costs as well. And this slide shows you some examples of what are in each of those primary cost pools, the services and the support units that are in those cost pools. So, for example, the facility operations and maintenance cost pool includes the cost for all of our custodial services, our land care, R&R, and so forth, If you look down at student services, that's going to include the admissions office, the orientation activities, student finance, and so forth. All of the support costs are in one of these cost pools, that if they are institutional level or campus level support costs.
Ms. Townsend,
yes.
Going back to 22 and then on 23 slides, I notice there are no numbers associated with any of these. Is there a rough number you can give us to what these pools actually consist of?
Yes, sir.
Or a very accurate number, either one?
Sure. Yes, sir. The year we're currently in, FY13, if you added up all of these, including utilities and debt service and so forth, it adds up to about $490 million. That is through the cost pools. When we first implemented the cost side of this model, Fitz showed you on an earlier slide the revenue implementation of the model where tuition and ICR began to be attributed to the colleges. That was way back in 98. The cost side where we created these cost pools didn't happen until 2007. And when we did that cost side, many people within the university thought we were going to allocate costs and attribute costs to incent behavior, much like we did on the revenue side. We're trying to get people to make decisions that would maximize revenue as best as possible. So they thought we were going to do this the same on the cost side. But it became clear to people as we got into it that we needed to talk about the cost attribution a little bit differently, because many of the costs a person in a department can't impact. A person in a department can't do a lot about the cost of our office, for example. So we thought of a different way to describe this as a way to provide information to the leaders of those units. And that is that the cost pools you can think about in three different ways. Some of them are consumption-based in that there is a direct connection between the activity in the department and the cost that they pay. And the examples here would be debt service and utilities. If I'm in a department and everybody in my department consistently shuts off their lights at night and shuts off their computer screen and so forth, I will see the benefit of that because my utility cost will go down. There's a direct connection. That's the consumption category. Most of our cost pools that you saw in the previous list are what we call cost driver based, where we're not actually measuring use of the service. Rather, we're creating a proxy for use, and that would be something like assignable square feet or headcount. So, for example, our technology cost pool is based, it's distributed out to the academic units as a cost based on their proportionate share of total headcount. We're not measuring how many times each employee, plugs into the wall and uses the computer or signs up through HR system for something. We're not measuring those activities. Rather, we're saying if you have this number of headcount, your potential for use is higher or lower than another unit with a higher or lower headcount. That's what the cost driver-based allocations are all about. So we're not measuring actual use. We've created proxies for use.
Ms. Townsend, I've got a couple of members who want questions. Representative Poppy's first, and then when she's finished, Representative Winkler. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to get a sense of, and I hope I'm not interrupting at an inappropriate time, but just the vertical and versus horizontal, as far as how the cost pools are working for, again, a research station or a university college department, and how do they have all of these pools that they're identifying? You started to talk about that as far as which ones are being impacted. So I guess to try to be clear on my question, how do the pools interact with the departments as far as what their looking at when they're developing their budget. Mm-hmm. That's clear.
Ms. Donaldson.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one thing to remember is that the model is implemented at that primary budget unit, so not at, from our perspective, it's not at a department level. We are not creating a charge for the Department of English. We are creating a charge for the College of Liberal Arts. That's important to understand. There are some colleges that have chosen to take pieces of the cost pools and allocate those costs down to their departments to incent particular behaviors, but that's a decision of the dean of the college or the chancellor of the campus in how to do that. But our charges go to every one of those academic primary budget units that were on the left side of 16. So every one of those is going to get charges. Now, they're going to get different charges based on their statistics by which these cost pools are distributed. So, and you will see on an upcoming slide some of that distribution, how the medical, what the medical school pays for, which looks a little bit different than what the College of Liberal Arts pays for because of the makeup of their activities and their people and their space and so forth. So I hope that you'll see that as we go a little bit further in here.
Representative Poppy, finish.
Just one other question, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just regarding facilities, operations, and maintenance. I know that obviously newer facilities probably are more cost efficient than older facilities. So just, and maybe this isn't the appropriate time right now, but to be talking about in the future, thinking about answering the question about the facilities and the cost and how do we actually reduce overall that expense for each department as well as the university.
Ms. Townsend.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a fine time to talk about that. The facilities pool, when we first implemented it, people within the community actually had the same thought. They would say, well, I'm in an old drafty building, this isn't fair. And we discovered through analysis some interesting things. The first thing was that really what varied, first of all, is utilities. Beyond utilities, the actual maintenance costs and the custodial and so forth doesn't differ a lot by building or use of building, but the utilities did. And surprisingly, the brand new buildings with sophisticated air handling systems were more expensive on the utility side to operate than the old drafty buildings. But we also have in place different programs through facilities management to help lower costs. So they will come in, for example, and do an energy audit for a department or a college or whatever level to try and help them figure out ways to lower their utility costs, as an example. And there's lots of different, and facilities management as a unit has been given reallocations through the years as well where they've had to cut their budget, and they have responded in different ways to reduce costs. So they've reduced the cost of providing custodial services, for example, for everybody. And then that gets spread across everybody because it's a pooled system. So I hope that answered your question.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, maybe she wants to finish the third point in the slide, and then I could.
All right. Ms. Townsend, why don't you do that? And Representative Johnson is after Representative Winkler.
Certainly. The third point on here was simply that we had one cost pool, which was the support service unit cost pool, which is a collection of a lot of offices, as I mentioned earlier, HR, General Counsel, President's Office, our office. The collection of those offices, we couldn't think of a good proxy for use of our services, and so we decided to distribute that one, we thought, in a reasonable way, which was based on total expenditures. So the academic units are charged for this cost pool based on their proportionate share of total expenditures, all funds, as kind of a reasonable way to spread that cost. We could have charged, for example, we could have made it more complicated and charged units every time our auditor went in and audited them, but that's not a very good incentive. We didn't want to get down to that level of complexity, so it's pooled in this way.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, just to underscore something about this model, while the attribution of cost is not entirely up to the local unit to modify or opt out of or change, one of the other features of this model for us is it does have an enormous amount of transparency for the university community. And because of that transparency, there is tension. So, for example, if we add another police officer in health and safety, that add of a police officer goes into the cost pool. By the way, that is itemized on our website, all the changes year over year in these cost pools. And the university community then sees that, and there is a discussion about that. And the fact that it's so transparent does actually put a tension back on Central not to grow this cost pools, because the colleges pay this, and the faculty know what's going on, and they question it. So there's a built-in tension. I can admit that there are people in the Central administration who don't particularly like that tension. The librarian doesn't always want the university community to know that it's okay that she wants people to know what her direct costs are, but the university community sees her indirect costs when we charge out the libraries. So that tension is really healthy, we think, in the system. And I'll go to questions.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a, this goes back to your slide 22, but it ties into 24. I missed, if you said it, what ICR is. But so that's part of the question. But in terms of federal grants, I understand that there's a negotiated overhead share of those grants. And I wonder where and how, I wonder where that negotiated share of the grant for overhead comes into this model and how that is, if that's comes in centrally and distributed out.
Mr. Fitzner.
Mr. Chairman, in this budget model, 100% of the ICR, which is called indirect cost recovery, is attributed directly to the college that earned that ICR through their sponsored grants from the federal agency. So that's all attributed to them, and it's attributed to them because they are paying all that cost back for that through the cost pool. So our ICR, we'll use that term, is a, if we get a $100,000 NIH grant, and it varies by federal agency, we get a $100,000 NIH grant, we will get $51,000 above that grant that represents the cost of using the lab where that research is done, paying the electrical bill, paying the grant administrator, paying the utility bill, the maintenance. That's on top of the direct cost, and that is given directly to the college. Now, that rate at 51, as we talked here the other day, we go through a laborious process every 3 years to justify our indirect cost recovery to the federal government. We can demonstrate an indirect cost recovery reimbursement rate well in excess of 60%, but the federal government, of course, doesn't want to pay that because they're trying to control their own costs. So that rate moves incrementally in small amounts year over year.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fitzenreiter, and Mr. Chair, this is extremely helpful for a new person coming in to understand how all of this works. So if the college is able to attract sufficient federal grants with sufficient ICR payments coming in, does their consumption-based allocation, cost driver-based allocation, or common good-based allocation get reduced as a result of that? Since I would imagine part of what this ICR is covering some of the same overhead that you are charging out to these colleges.
Ms. Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, members, the cost allocation isn't reduced. That is a form of revenue or a resource to pay the cost. Okay, that just like their appropriation or their tuition would pay the cost. So it isn't, it's just viewed as a resource to pay the cost, whether it's a direct, whether it's a cost within the college. ICR also covers departmental administration costs, for example, in the college. So that ICR will help pay for that. It will help pay for the utilities and the other cost pools as well.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm trying to get to is whether colleges that do extremely well in getting these ICRs are getting the money twice for the same overhead.
Mr. Chair and members, they're not getting the money twice. These unless I'm misunderstanding your question, these cost pools are not revenue. They're a charge. They're a bill that they have to pay. So they're getting a bill for utilities. They're not getting the revenue associated with that or right. equal to that. So they're getting a bill through the cost pools, and they're using the revenues on the left side of this chart to pay those bills. And ICR is a revenue for the college.
Representative,
that help?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Thomas, yes. I mean, I guess I understood that, but what I'm trying to kind of piece out here is colleges that get a lot of revenue for ICRs have a right. lot of their overhead paid for. And unless you're defining these overheads okay, differently between what they are able to, what they have to purchase centrally, mm-hmm. or what costs are they're billed for centrally, mm-hmm. compared to what they're actually providing for themselves within their own department. So in the sense I'm saying there, it's being paid for twice in the sense that they are getting charged from the central administration for a certain overhead mm-hmm. That they might also be getting money for from the grant in order to pay for on their own, so that they may not even use. or need to use what you're charging them.
Ms. Tonneson or Mr. Fitzenreiter?
Well, you can add if I'm not answering it, your version here. Mr. Chair and members, the one thing is the distribution of the cost pools is partly, it is sensitive to who does research and who doesn't, for example. So this is a piece of the puzzle. If you are a heavy research school, your costs for the research cost pool are going to be high. So you're going to have more overhead costs just naturally in the model because you do a lot of research. If you have a lot of space to do research, you're going to have more costs. So if I am a college that doesn't do a lot of research, College of Liberal Arts, Carlson School of Management, for example, I don't have hardly any costs for research infrastructure through this model. And I may have less facility costs if I don't have labs. Right. So on the next slide, it kind of shows you a little bit how those costs are distributed. These are examples by college. This is we can create a pie chart for every college and campus. But the medical school, for example, which is a huge, it's our largest unit, which you'll also see on the next slide, but it has expenditures here of $450 million a year. It has over 900,000 square feet of space assigned to it. And its cost, therefore, through the cost pools are heavily for the support service units, which are distributed based on expenditures, and for the facility-related costs, because it has such a large footprint. Whereas if you look at the College of Liberal Arts, its cost pools are more heavily on the student side because it has the largest student population of any on campus, on the Twin Cities campus. It also has then a larger share of the technology and the library cost because those are headcount-driven cost pools. So depending on your activity, and you see also in the medical school that they have the research portion of that pie is high because they do a lot of sponsored research. If you look down at the Carlson School of Management, that research piece of the pie is pretty much non-existent because they don't have those costs. And they also would not be getting the ICR because they don't have the costs.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Thompson, so the way it sort of works the other way, actually, by collecting that ICR revenue and getting a greater share of the cost allocation, in a way that federal overhead money is flowing back into the central administration for those shared costs.
Ms. Tonneson.
Mr. Chair and members, it is a portion of it, and that's what the actual ICR rate is driven by, some of those costs that are in central. The actual components of the ICR rate include the libraries, include the facility costs, include like the accounting services operation, all of which are in central. That's what the rate is, a portion of the rate is based on. And a portion of the rate is based on costs that occur within the college itself. So the departmental administration, which is not in central but in the college. So it is driven by those costs, and through this model, that's how they get those costs. Prior to this model, that ICR was split. The revenue was split, as we showed you on the earlier slide, 50-50, because 50% of the costs in the ICR formula were in the college, and 50% of the costs were in central. So the revenue was split. What we've done here in the model is move all the costs, 100% of them, to the college, so they get 100% of that revenue.
Representative Johnson, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to deconstruct some of the what seems to be kind of cumbersome language at times, at least to me, and try to understand exactly what you're talking about. So when you say cost allocated based on relative share of identified cost driver variable, if I said that to my neighbor, they wouldn't know what the heck I was talking about. So what are you talking about? What are the variables that you're talking about? Is that what's in the pie charts here? Is that the...
Okay, sure, I can explain.
Ms. Tonneson?
Mr. Chair and members. So it's hard to describe when they're all each a little different, so it's easier with an example, if you don't mind. So what that means is, let's take the technology, the information technology cost pool. So that's primarily our Office of Information Technology. That's the budget that's in that cost pool that we're paying for. And what we do is we take that total budget. It's roughly $60 million. We take that $60 million and we distribute it out as a cost to all of our academic units based on their proportionate share of total headcount, faculty, staff, and student headcount. So that's a headcount-based distribution. We take the cost and distribute it based on their proportionate share of total headcount. Another example, on the facility side, rather than headcount, we use assignable square feet. So we have a space database that identifies every square inch of space and who it's assigned to on the Twin Cities campus. And so we take the budget for facilities management, absent utilities, and we distribute that total out to our academic units as a cost, as a bill, based on their proportionate share of total assignable square feet. So that's what that variable is, assignable square feet or headcount or total expenditures. It's whatever we're distributing the cost based upon.
Representative Johnson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. So are those costs something that you can present to us that we can see?
Ms. Thompson.
Will we be seeing it later today yet?
Mr. Chair and members, those costs are the individual approved budgets for each one of our support units. I don't believe we have the actual dollar amounts in the presentation today. It does add up to that $498 million, but we can get it. It's a budget for Office of Information Technology, $60 million, for example, and our office budget. And
okay.
So.
That'd be great to see.
And just so members know, we will be returning to the U on Monday. Mr. Gehring is with us today, but he really has no voice. So we wait till Monday until he's fully recovered to do his presentation. Representative Fitzsimmons, unless Mr. Representative Johnson, are you finished? Representative Fitzsimmons.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We're talking about all these cost drivers in the school and the shared costs, and I go back to slide 6, which shows the students per tenured and tenure track faculty system wide, and it's got 28.7, and then going back to slide 5 with the total students at 68,418, and running that math, I come up with roughly 2,384 tenured faculty or tenured track faculty. And then on the previous slide, slide number 4, it had 25,000 headcount employees, which then if my math's correct, it's 22,616 non-tenured faculty or non-tenured track faculty. And I just wanted to make sure, is that correct? And can we get some kind of breakdown on what that faculty is?
Mr. Carlson?
Or what, that employees?
Yeah.
Yes, non-faculty employees.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I have a 2012 count of 2,387 tenure track faculty.
Okay, yeah, I was off by 3. Yeah.
That's just
pretty good.
pretty good math, absolutely. And we will be talking later in this presentation about a cost benchmarking study that really tore apart the entire employee base in various ways. We've been working actually quite hard at being able to classify the other 23,000 employees, which also includes graduate students, graduate assistants, by the way. So yes, we will be able to do that.
Right.
Representative Fitzsimmons, you have another question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. No, I appreciate you recognizing the importance, because it's a factor of nearly 10-to-1 of employees that are not faculty, not teaching in the classroom, and just getting a grasp of what that looks like. So thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, bear in mind that headcount number includes the folks in parking or housing or all activities.
I recognize that. That's why it would be very enlightening to see what that actual breakdown is on for those departments. Thank you.
Any other questions? Sorry. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came in late, so I apologize if I'm misunderstanding the slide in front, and I also apologize for being late. The example cost pool distributions by college. So are you giving an example of how you allocate fund from the home office, or is it actually allocated and then managed at each of those sites and others, because it says these are examples?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committees, what this chart is meant to show you is how our distribution of the costs, the utilities or the debt service or the cost of the student registration system or the like, impacts the individual colleges differently. That's what this chart is, these pie charts are meant to show you.
Okay, that's a little different in it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And at some point, are we gonna move into the management of once money, you have it and it gets allocated out, and the management aspect of it? Are we going to get to that at some point, or is that later on as we get to the line items?
Fitz and Ryder, how do you want to answer that?
I'm not exactly sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, what you exactly mean by the by that question. We take it offline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, you have a very large budget at the University of Minnesota, and the main office has a central budget, but money then goes out either through research grants, through allocations to colleges, to departments to be spent, and I'm curious as we move along how that money is managed and what kind of accountability there is and transparency once you make those decisions about who gets what money, and maybe that's not for today. I guess I'm just wondering how, are we going to get to that?
I think we'll get to some of that here as we move along.
Okay.
And if we don't, we'll
follow up. Thank you.
Yeah, and members, remember to continue to ask just in case there's an oversight, as unlikely as that might be. Representative Swinnitz, you have another question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This kind of dovetails a little bit with Representative Norton's question. Looking at your pie charts again, you know, obviously we have investments from other areas of the state beyond, so from a bonding perspective and actual construction costs, have we ever kind of dived into that as far as, you know, beyond higher educational investment? Have we looked at, you know, when we're looking at cost drivers and we're looking at utility disbursements within the each of the colleges and costs, have you ever thought of adding, you know, what the investment from the state standpoint when it comes to a bonding proposal or reconstruction if we're rebuilding campus buildings? Because, you know, if we're looking at, we talked a little bit about all costs when we were talking about the federal grants and what process that does and what part that takes when it comes to utilities and payments and overhead. Has that ever been kind of brought into the fold as well?
Mr. Chairman, members, Fitz in this Ryder. Pie chart and in our cost pools, the colleges, so I'll give you an example. If a college, if we bring a capital project, which we do quite often, to the legislature, we are responsible for one-third of that obligation. That obligation is an obligation of the occupants of that building in our budget model. And that cost of that debt service or the cost of the new building operations is charged through this budget model.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So your one-third is part of that. But I'm saying, like, from the state's portion outside of the institution's itself costs, you know, because it's a, if we're looking at government support and of the, you know, from a taxpayer standpoint, looking outside in, you know, obviously a third of the costs are kind of generated or revenued through you, but from the outside looking in, all costs. I guess that's maybe the clarification I'm looking for.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think I understand the question, and it's really looked at not so much in the when we're doing the operating budget, but when we're setting the capital budget.
Yeah. While there's a slight pause here, I do want to thank Representative Norton. She has shared with the chair two very interesting lists of salaries at the University of Minnesota. I would encourage other members of the committee, if they're doing research, and I hope they are on the side, if you would share them with the chair. I don't share them with anyone else unless they would allow me to do so, but if you're gathering information, which you should be doing, we are encouraging sharing. So if you share with the chair and you tell me to let the rest of the committee know, I will do that. But those two lists are very interesting. So
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in a package that we delivered to the committee on Monday to Mr. Malander, those salary charts were provided, and we were going to reference them later in the presentation. It is public information. Mm-hmm. We have no problem with that distribution.
We're just making sure that when members are doing work on their own, that we recognize it, and I think the totality of it will be rewarded at the end of session for everyone involved.
Mr. Chairman, we'll just keep driving here. One last thing about the...
This is the sort of the last slide in this part of the presentation, and it's a display of our academic units and the coordinate campuses in terms of their revenue mix. And really, just a couple of quick messages from this one. Besides the relative size of the units that you can see here, a couple of other interesting points are that the green, the kind of lime green over on the left, represents the state appropriation, and you can see that every academic unit and every coordinate campus still continues to get some state appropriation. It just must, much like the state, it is concentrated based on size, and if we get cut, we have to go where the money is as well. But you can see that every unit still does get state money. And then secondly, just the different revenue mixes. So when we talk about undergraduate tuition policy, not every college or campus thinks about it the same way or cares about it, because their revenue isn't so dependent on undergraduate tuition. CLA and the college and Duluth and Carlson School of Management are very dependent on tuition. If you look at the medical school, tuition is a very small proportion of their total revenues, and they're going to care much more about the federal fiscal cliff and what that might do to their federal research funding and so forth. So depending upon the unit that you're looking at, they're going to have different concerns and different things that they need to manage in terms of their revenues. So that's the end of that one.
We'll now move into just a very, again, a high-level overview of the revenue and expenditures of the university and how we think about it and the way we talk about it to help perhaps for you to understand and maybe even communicate with us better. But we do, and the board does approve an all-funds budget of the university. We immediately parse that budget into two buckets. There is a sponsored component to the bucket, to the revenues in the university, and sponsored, these are a lot of accounting terms, I'm going to apologize, but sponsored expenditures, that's really the research portfolio of the institution. That money is considered an exchange transaction with NIH, where they give us money and we do research and give them a report back. There is an entire set of regulatory framework around that money, huge reporting responsibilities, tracking responsibilities, an enormous effort on the part of the faculty and commensurate staff to make grant applications, receive that money, track that money, spend that money, enormous effort. We'll talk more about how much that amounts at the university shortly. And then I guess the accountants, which I'm not one of, decided that if we had sponsored spending, everything else would be non-sponsored. So non-sponsored spending at the university really is the annual operating budget of the institution, setting aside that sponsored research, which often are multi-year awards. And on the non-sponsored side, and we're just going to go down this, peel this onion all the way, is we spend a lot of time on all of this, but there are locally generated revenues, and then we have other buckets that we talk with the Board of Regents about that we call centrally allocated and attributed. It's the state O&M, the state specials, the tuition, the ICR central reserves. That's just a high-level way we organize our thinking and the accounting around the university. But the real complexity of our accounting system and our budget is on this chart. We've talked just a short while ago about those 51 academic and support units, the primary organizational unit at the university. Underneath that, in our accounting system, are about, it varies, but it's about 419 departments. So think of the medical school and the Department of Pediatrics. Okay, then underneath that, a department may decide, and there are over 200, almost 2,100 activities. So you got medical school, pediatrics, and they may want to, by their own choice, track juvenile diabetes. So they will. It's medical school, pediatrics, juvenile diabetes, and any one of those activities could be funded by up to 82 different flavors of money, whether that's state special money, whether that's endowment money, auxiliary money, clinical income, grants and contracts, federal, there's 82 different sources of funds. It's at the state level, it's kind of like having activity funded partly by the Trunk Highway Fund, partly by the Game and Fish Fund, partly by the General Fund, partly by the Workers' Comp Fund, or the, you know, it's a complex set of funds that support the activities of the institution. But it goes several steps further. The actual budgeting and spending occurs in an account. And in that account, and those grow every year, at our last count recently, there was 108,000 unique accounts where budgeting and spending occurs in the institution. And we have to track that spending by function code, instruction, research, public service, etc., and by that object of expenditure, what some call the natural classification, salary, fringe, supplies, equipment, etc., and we have to track it by a revenue code. So you can imagine the what we call the chart string to keep track and dice this budgeting and accounting system. And we can add from the bottom up to the top and sideways, and it is an enormous system. And every time, for example, that we receive another $5,000 from a donor, that donor is going to want to know how their money is spent. It gets put in a college, in a department, in an activity, in a fund, in an account, and then we have to track it and report back to the donor as our fiduciary responsibility, because they often want to know, almost all of them want to know, how did you spend the money? So there's an enormous infrastructure around, just because of all the reporting and accountability we have, this is the result of the general ledger at the institution.
Fitzenrider, Representative Lean, I think, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fitzenrider, I understand the money is tracked based on what you just said, these codes and everything, but how is the determination made as to which fund funds these certain activities?
Yeah, Mr.
Fitzenrider.
Mr. Chairman, members, there is a set of definitions that for each one of these funds that the units deposit those dollars into. We monitor to make sure they're using the correct codes throughout this system, because of course we want to make sure that on the back end we're doing the proper accounting and proper reporting. But there is, of course, on the function code side, I'll give you an example, that's a tough and one reason we have definitions is higher ed does try to make, we'll get to the comparisons to peer institutions, there is a national set of definitions. But I can tell you that our experience has been that when you try to compare across institutions with this data, it's very, very difficult, because they are subject to interpretation by the individuals and in all of the universities and colleges across the country. Comparative data is difficult to, it's interesting, informative, but it is, our experience has been, it's pretty fraught with problems.
Representative Lee.
Thank you. Again, just moving very quickly, the total expenditures, as I said, we keep track by object of expenditure. We are a people business. Almost two-thirds of our spend is in salaries and compensation. And as I said, we have to keep track of it by function. This is just a recent trend at the university for our non-sponsored side, the annual operating budget. The top purple line is just the salary portion of what we spend. You can see it's been relatively flat during this time period. We have not had large pay increases. It's been flat. You can see the green there as our fringe benefits. Good news there is we are seeing in particular, our healthcare costs plateau. Those have slowed in their trajectory in just the last couple of years. And you can see a sampling of the other items. But we are a people business, and our biggest expense is the salary and fringe costs of the institution. This gives you just a quick view of how that mix has changed since 1998. I picked 1998 because, frankly, this chart going back further is distorted because the university at the time had a hospital, and it kind of distorts the the data, but you can see the declining, it's not a secret, the declining state share as a percent of the total budget, the increasing cost of our part that tuition's played, and it just gives you sort of the trajectory of what's the changing mix at the university. I bounced past
one. Yeah, you went past one. Representative Winkler has a question while you're
disappeared
going.
Disappeared on the chart, Mr. Chairman.
Let's hope that's not going to be.
It wasn't intentional, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Winkler. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fitzenreiter, popping back to your slide 30. On the right-hand side of the divide, and I'm sure, please tell me why I'm wrong, that a total of 35% of the university's budget goes to teaching and research, instruction and research, of the non-sponsored funds.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is the what we have to be careful of here, the fraught with danger on function codes. The function code instruction represents, because of the way we're all have to track it, represents the compensation of the faculty member and some attributed supply expense. So I wouldn't interpret that number to be what it costs to educate a student. It merely represents the direct expense of the faculty member teaching in the classroom and some supply budget. And the research one is the non-sponsored. The big piece of sponsored research is the $800 million we're going to get to in another slide. This is the non-sponsored side, which we do other research besides. We do research with state money that isn't sponsored.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, and thank you. Mr. Fitzenreiter, this function by function pie chart is a... If I understand you, it's to show the breakdown of how a typical faculty member's compensation would be divided into these various functions. I didn't understand that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's all in those 107,000 accounts out there. Those accounts that paid a faculty member's salary that had a function code instruction is what that 26% represents when you add it up for the whole institution. I will tell you one other thing here is that it's our hope, maybe, that we'll get a chance. We'd be happy to present it here at a later date if you have time. We've done a more comprehensive review of our mission activities to take the, we know what this tells us is what our, kind of gives us an accounting view of our direct expenses. But what's the, we wanted to know, and President Kaler wanted to know, what's the fully allocated cost of our mission activities? What is the indirect cost of educating an undergraduate student plus the direct instructional cost for the faculty member? What's that cost the institution to educate a student? What's the fully loaded cost of research, direct and indirect? So we took our entire $3 billion spend and did a cost accounting exercise, which is difficult, and identified our fully loaded cost of instruction, research, public service, auxiliaries, and financial aid. And we'd be happy to share that with you. It's a very interesting study.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, this is very helpful. This presentation is very helpful for understanding the nuts and bolts of how you do your work. The challenge that we have is that a lot of people would like university and higher education in Minnesota to be at its very best, and there is a disconnect between public perception, public discussion, and public understanding of what the mission is and how the costs break down, and it's not easy to piece that together. So I think that follow-up discussion would be very helpful.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, I want to compliment the chair of the committee. I've been at this, as I said earlier, for 20 years, and we have not always had an opportunity in the legislative process to talk about how the university spends its money and how it allocates its money. We know it's a complex topic and it's going to take some time, but we want to have that discussion with you.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, we want that to be an ongoing discussion now. So we have to understand it. and this pertains to your budget presentation and to the budget presentations for all of higher ed, including the governor. There has to be a thorough understanding of what's happened here and what is going to happen.
So, Mr. Chairman, just moving on, I know there's a break point having to come. Again, this chart just gives you our 2012 annual research report summary that's given to the Board of Regents. Our research awards were roughly $750 million, a slight decrease from 2011, but it was actually almost a 7.5% increase if you take out the ARRA, American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funding. The university did very well applying for those grants, but right now you will see a slight decrease because those grants are spinning off and having been spent and wound down. You can see our ranking nationally here for a little bit of comparative information.
Thank you.
We rank 13th overall, and we rank 8th among publics. This gives you a breakdown.
Mr. Fitzgerald, just on that ranking for a second, where did you rank when the cuts came compared to those universities?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that at the top of my head, but we can get that for you.
Yeah, get it. Sure. Because of my recollection was that we had some discussion of that last session, or at least it was from your side that there was a discussion of it, but I would like to see that too, and as we go forward. Representative Whitney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know I'm asking a lot of questions, but if you would just give me a little...
The intent of this, so go ahead.
Roll of the eyes if I'm going too much, please do so. Sponsored research is important, but... And you could correct me if I'm wrong, it's my understanding that something like 60% of academic research is actually corporate-sponsored research. And that's probably an aggregate number and may not apply to the University of Minnesota. But I wonder if you, and if you go back to slide, one of your slides anyway has the grant and contract.
26.
Look at this bipartisanship.
Mr. Chairman,
the slide 26 shows grants / contracts, and I guess what I'm wondering is if that if the grant / contracts categorical ties out to this research report summary includes contracts for research rather than federal research grants.
Ms. Tonneson?
Mr. Chairman, members, he's a great setup guy. He didn't look to the next slide, and I think the answer's on this slide. I think.
Fitzenrath.
What this slide is shows you the of that $750 million, the source of that money. So you can see that the lighter blue there, almost sky blue, not sky blue, but the 38% is from NIH. Then you can see the Department of Education, Department of Defense, DHHS, state and local government, private foundations, National Science Foundation, agriculture, energy, and then other federal and business and industry. You can see the source. To answer your 60% question, business and industry at the university is not 60% of our research. The bulk of it is federal government. And you can see on the pie chart next to it, who the major recipients of that federal money are. So medical school is certainly a big piece, public health, and agriculture.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't remember, Mr. Fitzgerald, I don't know what that 60% may represent total amount of R&D that takes place in an economy or something like that, as opposed to academic R&D. This little tiny bright yellow slice, this 8%, is UMC, UMD, UMM, and UMR. So essentially, 92% of all research takes place at the Twin Cities campus.
Mr. Fitzgerald,
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Why?
Mr. Fitzgerald?
Mr. Chairman, just different missions. Morris is not, is an undergraduate, small undergraduate campus. Crookston does some research. UMD does probably the next biggest piece of that. I'll just be honest, research is very expensive to do.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chairman, I would just ask, they don't have a medical school at Crookston, so they're not going to be a big player in that. They don't have a big science and engineering effort at Morris or Crookston.
Mr. Chair, I guess I think Duluth and Rochester, and Rochester's new, but Duluth, it seems to me, is really where the question lies. Why doesn't more research activity take place there, where they actually do have a small medical school, anyway, and certainly...
Mr. Fitzwright,
for purposes of this chart, is part of the Twin Cities.
Representative Poppy, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just along those research lines, because once again I represent the Hormel Institute, which is a very strong research institute and brings in millions of dollars, and I'm just wondering about the digging down to be able to show that the dollars that are brought in through the institute, because not everything is in the Twin Cities, and I'm just wondering either on number 34 or 35 or beyond to be able to have that layout so that we can see where those dollars do come from and how much, because I think that because the University of Minnesota, as has been stated many times, is a university that serves the entire state, and we're doing a disservice if we continue to reference just the Twin Cities as the place where everything happens, and I just wanted to be able to ask you to provide that kind of detail so we can see that.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you would see that in the 8%, sort of the maroon, I believe it's buried in there, and we can break it out.
Representative Swedinski, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. Kind of going back to 34, we've got the list and the rankings from Johns Hopkins to us, Columbia, Penn State.
Right.
Then we kind of flip forward. We see where we're sitting at. Obviously, we're at the $850 million. And then you look at the business portion, that 7% slide on the funding source on slide 35. How do we compare in the other schools within those same ranks when it comes to, you know, these are our clients, whether it be the federal government, whether it be a business and industry. How are we doing compared to them? I mean, if we went to Johns Hopkins, are they looking at 50% of their budget, kind of as Representative Winkler talked about, with 60%? How are we comparing when it comes to actually attracting, you know, if we're just tunneling, doing more governmental style research rather than industry, my guess is there may be more financial gain when it comes to patents and shares and things, when it comes to business and some of that. Just that would be something I'd be interested in seeing. So more of a comment, I guess, than a question.
Mr. Chairman, members, excellent question, and one that you should ask again when President Kaler is before you. Because he's very proud of a new initiative he's put in place to try to take down the barrier at the University of Minnesota for our relationship with business and industry, to try to encourage more business and industry grants at the University of Minnesota. We've had a very risk-averse, legal kind of relationship with business and industry in Minnesota, and President Kaler's attempting to take that down. We can get to the actual comparisons, but I will tell you the reason the president is attempting to take those barriers down is we're not doing as well as we should compared to others.
Representative Doral, I believe you have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to approve the January 28th minutes.
Representative Doral moves to approve the minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, I'm going to encourage you again to keep your materials in your folder and also to keep the questions that you want to ask in the future and reminders of what we will begin on Monday. And if Mr. Gehring is 100%, we'll have him do a presentation first and then we'll return to the University of Minnesota. So thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.